Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. Online, we're at kpcg.fm. We have a live link to at thetrumpet.com. Coming up on this Wednesday edition, we talked a little bit about finances the other day. Here's six ways that you can save some money, because it's getting harder and harder to do that. We've got some good details about that for you. Also, an update about the bees. We talked about that yesterday. Something kind of interesting that came in from a listener about honeybees. And also, what's going on with the wet foot, dry foot situation? The Cubans, they're still fleeing, trying to get to the U.S. That and more this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live. We're at 101.3 KPCG. And again, online at kpcg.fm. Thanks for listening there. Live link at thetrumpet.com as well. Hope you're having a great Wednesday. I'm Dwight Falk and Grant Turgeon here today. We've had some really nice weather. And 80, it was the 90s on Monday. It was the 80s yesterday. And today it's in the 60s. So I guess by Saturday we'll be down in the teens if it keeps
going
that way.
That's how it's been going, so not too surprising anymore.
No, it's nice to get a little bit of more, I guess, probably more normal weather. It's weird. It throws the body off when it's still, technically it was still winter and it was 90, 92 or 3 degrees. That just doesn't seem right, unless you're by the beach.
Yeah, because I guess they do get pretty specific about when winter ends and spring starts. But usually they're saying end of March, it's still in winter, but usually it doesn't feel like it anymore at all.
No, it always feels much more like the, whatever season you're coming into, usually before you even get there officially on the calendar. Trumpet Daily Radio Show today with your host Stephen Fleury talked about more about the trade wars that are ongoing, and they've really been hammering on that over the last week. It's just so much to talk about there, and there's so much happening. So make sure you listen for that program, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. And you can get the archives at thetrumpet.com and kpcg.fm. Also, we have a few replays throughout the day as well. And it's interesting looking at just some of the headlines today in relation to that, just Drudge Report's top headlines. Here they are. Stocks sour, worst day since election, ending longest streak of calm since 1995, tax cut doubts royal markets. One-third of Americans would have trouble finding emergency $2,000. Sears warns of substantial doubt about company's future. Payless filing for bankruptcy as soon as next week. And art sales lowest point since financial crisis. None of that is good news when it comes to money.
Doesn't seem like the best time for a trade war necessarily.
No, it's amazing. All the things that are happening. And these, as is pointed out on the Trumpet Daily program today, there are some troubling past alliances that are coming back together, you know, Germany, Japan, and of course China's in the mix there too. So really interesting program today. And as was pointed out on the show, when you hear the term trade war, sometimes that's about as exciting as drying paint. But it's very, very important. And so there's a lot of really good info that you need to hear there. And but yeah, you look at the headlines and it's just it's negative when it comes to the finances. So we'll see what happens with all of that. Of course, economies go up and down, but there has been a lot of write-ups about the housing market being kind of in a bubble again. There's a lot of debt out there. I saw a headline today that the average American will die with $63,000 in debt.
What? How is that even? And here we are supposed to have 1 million. In savings for retirement, and yet $63,000 is what people die in debt with.
Right, and you know, the hope is you leave something for your kids, you know, some sort of an inheritance of some kind, anything, you know, any little bit, and but people are dying with debts. So, and now in some cases those debts kind of die with them, but in some cases the family is responsible in some ways, I suppose. It could be mortgage debt. It could be a lot of different types of debt. So those are just not good headlines when it comes to the finances. And that's, I think that's the average. So obviously some would die with savings to pass on, but some would die with a lot of debt too.
Yeah, and debt is a really big problem, not just for the people who have it, but for those people's parents, for those people's children. I mean, when parents get older, it's also nice to try and take care of them if possible, instead of putting them away in a home if possible. And then also with children, if you have a little bit saved up for them, maybe you could help offset some of the massive college loans that a lot of students get now.
Yeah. So it's we do live in a debt-fueled society for sure. And so that does tie into with just different trade wars and situations financially that are going on. So make sure you listen for that Trumpet Daily Radio Show that's coming up here in just a bit on KPCG. Or again, you can listen to the archives online. Also, headlines from thetrumpet.com today. The top story, the analysis piece, is British University to create three-parent babies. You heard that right. that just sounds like something you wouldn't expect to hear. But there have been stories about that where they're trying to, you know, mix up the potion a little bit there differently and see what comes of it. Doesn't seem like that would be a good idea, but I guess they're going to find out what comes from it.
Yeah, it really doesn't sound appealing at all, and hopefully that is no one's first choice, at least. That just sounds horrible.
Yeah, I don't know if they're thinking that it's going to make like a super baby of some kind. And how confusing would that be? You know, who are your parents? You know, well, I come from three. And, you know, if they do three, why would they stop there? Why
exactly.
would it be 20?
Yeah. So is this just sort of a way of, like, combining the genes of all three people, or is it, like, having a surrogate mother or something like that?
I haven't read all the details. My assumption is, based upon some of the other things I've read, they're just trying to mix that up to where, again, they're pulling in just different genes from people. So it's going to be really interesting to see where that goes. I don't think it's going in a good direction, of course. You can read all of the details there. Just a teaser. Just giving you a teaser for that article, thetrumpet.com. British University to create three-parent babies. And there's some related stories to that. If you've noticed thetrumpet.com, the new feature there is that they have their featured analysis piece and then a few related stories. Mm-hmm. And so a few of the related ones are genetically modified humans coming soon, as written by Dennis Leap back in March 1st, and then Skirting the Law by Mark Jenkins. That was from a few years back. So those all tie in. So that's kind of nice. You get a few related articles about the topic. You can go from there.
Yeah, that's really a disturbing trend and really worth reading a lot about. I mean, it's almost like humans are trying to play God, who gave us the authority to play with life. And who knows what kind of things could be wrong with the baby if you're trying to, you know, mix genes up in the pool like that.
Yeah, exactly. It's it just seems like a bad science fiction movie of some kind where they start out with all these maybe good intentions, but it ends up badly. Mm. And who knows how it'll end up, but it just, again, it's not something that would occur in nature. And so if it's something that wouldn't occur in nature, a lot of times there's a reason it doesn't occur in nature. And so, scientists are playing with things that are probably a little beyond their control. And so I don't think it'll go in a good direction.
Yeah. And it's interesting. In the Bible, God challenges people to see if they can create life like he can and things like that. I'm pretty sure at this point, scientists realize we absolutely can't create life, but it's almost like we're trying to go as far as we possibly can to at least have some kind of control over that process. Really, I don't see the need for it, though. I mean, maybe they have some sort of idealistic reasons for doing something like that. If maybe one parent has a defect in the genes and they're trying to offset that with healthier genes, maybe at least if they had some sort of a good reason to try it, but even still, the risk just seems to outweigh the possible benefits there.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of what it is, at least as far as the initial thought that, if you're, you know, you may have a disease or a weakness, we could fix that for you. Mm. But first of all, usually it doesn't work the way they hope. And also, then it's used for all kinds of things. You know, there's been write-ups over the years about people wanting designer babies. You know, you can pick out what you want, eye color, you know, this, that, and the other. And so I think we mentioned it before, but, you know, people have different tastes and things, and sometimes they're you know, pretty nice. At other times, it's a little, it doesn't quite work as well. And it's good that we can't totally choose what our kids look like. We'd probably make some mistakes.
Exactly. Yeah. There. I guess the other extreme, and that this has happened in the past with eugenics and things like that, is you just wouldn't let someone with a defect have children at all. Like, you would actually try to prevent them from having children. Now it looks like maybe we're trying to let them have children, but control every little bit of it to make sure that it's not passed on to the kid. However, when you start meddling scientifically like that with the genes, it could actually turn out worse than just letting nature take its course.
Right. So pretty interesting write up there at thetrumpet.com. Stop and check that out. In relation to the finances and money and things that are in relation to that, here's some tips that could help you. I mean, even if there's a lot of debt and there's trade wars, you still have to do your best personally, for as long as you can anyway, to save some money. And CNBC says has this headline, 6 smart ways to save your money, according to people who've actually done it.
I hope so.
They've actually saved some. They say, number one, this is a great tip, skip the credit cards, use cash instead, while you still can. There's some thought about getting rid of cash, but CNBC reporter Kathleen Elkins went on a cash diet. Not a crash diet, but a cash diet for 2 months, and allotted herself $60 a week to spend on everything that wasn't rent and her electric bill. So a little fun money, as it were. She also recorded every penny she spent in a spreadsheet so she could see exactly what she was buying and where she could make cuts. After those 8 weeks were up, she had saved $1,000, more than she usually does in just 2 months. Because it's so easy to spend on a credit card. And sometimes you have to, and it's smart to do that. I mean, if you're buying airline tickets or something online, of course. But we've talked about this before. You go to the store. If you've got a certain amount of cash in your pocket and that's all you've got, it's harder to part with it than if it's just ringing up the credit card.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Psychologically, it's been proven that most human beings have a much harder time spending cash than they would just basically handing over a piece of plastic that maybe represents a certain amount of money on there, but we don't really know. And another good thing, though, is if you can't necessarily switch to cash entirely, still keep it on a spreadsheet or still keep track of every purchase like that, because it seems like even if you're not just using cash, as long as you're extremely aware of what you're buying and you track it closely, you could also make cuts that way too.
Yeah, so it's a good idea if you can do it, and it is a little painful. Because it's easy to just kind of overspend and not pay attention to it. But when you're on that cash diet, you do have to stick to it if that's all you've got. Another tip they say is pretty good is to pay yourself early. You know, your money can go a lot of places, but you have to make sure that after a few essential things are taken care of, you need to save a little bit. A couple who realized that they had spent $30,000 eating out in 1 year missed out on the opportunity to do one crucial thing before digging into their meals, invest in themselves before some of those other expenditures. Most experts recommend setting aside about 10%, a tithe roughly, of your income into some sort of a retirement fund or a savings fund if you can do that. And they say that can really help. So it's easy to, you know, say, well, I've got $100, I'm just going to spend it. As opposed to saving it, you know, and if you're not spending it on an essential, life wouldn't be a lot of fun if you never spent anything, obviously. But it again, I think the point is you spend it and, you know, all of a sudden you look back a year later and you're like, we spent how much eating out? $30,000? You think about how much what you would do with that money if you had it. We've all had those thoughts from time to time.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm surprised, though, that article doesn't think that eating out is an investment in yourself. It does seem like you're adding to yourself or something like that. But, yeah, even if you don't have a whole lot of income over the course of a year, just saving 10% would give you $2,000 or $3,000, something like that, too.
Yeah. So it's really, really pretty interesting to see how it adds up. And yeah, I've had that thought about things. Like, how much have I spent over the years on such and such?
It's funny too, because you still, even if you knew that you spent $30,000 in a year, you're like, well, those are some pretty good steak dinners, though. I don't know if I would have actually passed those up.
It's a cost benefit analysis, I guess. They say also don't bother skipping the coffee. Think bigger. Not that you couldn't skip the coffee. They're talking, of course, about like some of your fancier coffees.
Right.
The expensive ones. They say self-made millionaire Grant Cardone lays down the law. It says you can't just skip a $3 cup of coffee and expect to be rolling in dough within a year. He must have written that a long time ago because you can find a $3 cup of coffee.
Isn't that a part of false hope syndrome too? Thinking that somehow you're going to accumulate thousands of dollars just from skipping that cheap coffee?
Exactly. It says, but he does have other ideas like setting really high savings goals. And like the couple who spent $30,000 on dining out, making sure you invest some of that in your future as well. He said, I've never looked to get rich quick, but I did want to save up. And so that's something that he did. He didn't worry too much about some of the littler things. He tried to set bigger goals. Not to say that the little things add up too, and those are good. But again, like you say, I mean, if you're what do they call that? Penny wise and pound foolish.
Right.
You know, you're saving all the nickels and dimes, but you're spending huge amount on something else. That's not the best way to do it.
Yeah, if you're still going on $1,000 shopping sprees while cutting out Starbucks, it's not really going to do much for you at all. But yeah, he makes a really good point there. I've also experienced that as well. If I ever had some sort of relatively short-term saving goal, it's actually really motivating to start putting money aside and see, you know, this is a pretty hard goal to set, but let's see if I can actually save this much in this short amount of time. And, you know, especially as a man, the challenge is really enjoyable for me.
Yeah, it is a challenge. And once you get the ball rolling in a good way, that's pretty fun.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it takes a bit to get it rolling in the good way, though. And they say, if you can, it's not bad to generate two incomes or more. Not everybody can do that, but sometimes you can. The example they use here is a pretty interesting one. It's of Jay Leno, the famous comedian and Tonight Show host of years gone by. He says, when I was younger, I would always save the money I made working at the car dealership, and I would spend the money I made as a comedian. So he had his day job, and then he'd do his comedic stuff at night.
Interesting.
And he says, when I started to get a bit famous, the money I was making as a comedian was way more than the money I was making at the car dealership, but he kept working there. So I would bank the comedian money and spend the car dealership money. So
Brilliant.
He was always saving the bigger portion. And he kept the habit. When he started hosting NBC's Tonight Show, he booked himself hundreds of comedy gigs. Even when he was doing the Tonight Show, he was still out on the road doing comedy. And, of course, he would have made good money because everyone would want to come see him. His gig money was his spending money, and he banked his late-night money. To this day, he says he hasn't spent any money that he made on the Tonight Show. He still hasn't.
He's out of TV now, right? Isn't he retired from all that?
Right.
So... yeah, I also heard of, I believe Marshawn Lynch never spent a penny of his entire NFL paycheck.
Really?
Any of his NFL paychecks, because he would just spend the endorsement money he got. And so he's in the same boat now where he has tens of millions of dollars, if not hundreds of millions, that he hasn't even touched.
Yeah.
That's really smart if you do have two incomes like that to spend the smaller one.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a pretty remarkable for, in Jay Leno's example, that he... even when he started making pretty good money doing the comedy, he still was working at the car dealership. I imagine he would have been a great car salesman.
Mm-hmm.
He's just very personable, and he loves cars. He has that huge collection of automobiles, and I think he's even done some shows about that. And so, but a lot of times, you know, people will, if they start making more doing one thing, they'll just get rid of the other job because it'd be easy to feel like, well, that's beneath me. You know, I'm this famous comedian. You know, hey, didn't I see you at the car dealership? But he kept doing it, and so that seems like a really good idea.
Yeah,
not possible for everybody, you know,
right.
But in some cases, maybe it is.
Yeah, and it's not important. It's also important to realize the how much you need a really good work ethic to do something like that to finish your day job and go to a night job.
Yeah.
So if anyone's going to take that option, it's going to take up most of your waking hours. So that's also important to realize.
Right. And I imagine when he got done with his comedy show, it was later.
Oh, yeah.
And he still had to come in to do the car dealership stuff. So maybe he tested his material on the customer. Hey, what do you think of this joke?
He nailed every late night because he was bombing in front of the car dealership customers.
Yeah. If they didn't laugh, then he knew, I'm not going to put this one on my act. And the last thing that they say is you can automate things in terms of your savings. I guess this is kind of a depend on personal preference, but you can set up your bank accounts to withdraw a certain amount and put it some certain place. And sometimes that's nice because you don't even have to think about it. It just happens. And so you're not tempted to spend it because it's just in the budget.
Right. It's almost like thinking about the money you save as another expenditure, just making it an automatic withdrawal or something like that, so that it's like the monthly mortgage payment. You have to save this much, and so you just automatically take it out, make it automatic, don't even think about it.
Yeah, and so that can be a good thing. They say that even with, like, say, car payments. If you have a car payment, once you pay it off, if you can, you should just keep saving the car payment because, lo and behold, a few years down the road, you need another car.
Right.
And it's nice to have at least a decent down payment when you go into to the dealership and you're facing a guy like Jay Leno, who's good at selling you cars. You got to have some cash for that.
That 20% interest.
Yes, that's right. This is an interesting one. This was sent in from a listener after listening to our bee story yesterday. You know, where are all the bees going? This is from lifehacker.com. They say, don't plant those bee-friendly wildflowers Cheerios is giving away. Cheerios, as you may have heard, they have the bee as their little logo, their mascot, I guess you'd call it. They've taken them off the box, as I understand it, because to highlight the fact that the bee population is diminishing, and we need those, of course, for pollination. But so what they're doing is they're giving away seeds to plant more flowers, which is great. But there might be some seeds in there that don't work with, depending on what area you're in, because you don't want to plant something that's not native because it can cause problems. So there's a few, and there's a little bit of debate about this, like, you know, if the seeds can be planted everywhere or not. But some people think you can't plant all of them in every place. For example, the California poppy is nice in California, but it is listed as an invasive exotic pest plant in southeastern states. So it's a good thing they're trying to do. And they said probably a lot of the seeds work really well, but you just have to be careful that you don't start planting something in your yard that is considered to be a bad plant and might, you know, take up another plant that should be there. And that happens with animals a lot, where somebody will dump a python out in the Everglades, and all of a sudden we got pythons everywhere. But in this case, even trying to do something good with the flowers, you've got to have a little bit of understanding of what should be planted where.
Yeah, my brother told me last week that evergreen trees aren't even native to Oklahoma, but for some reason, I don't know if this is even true, but this is what he told me, so I'm taking my 16-year-old brother's word for it. But he said that the basically, the evergreen seeds were dropped off here, and then now we see them all over the state, all over campus here, and all over the place. So it just goes to show how fast something could spread. Thankfully, evergreen trees aren't a hazard or a problem for our ecosystem, as far as I know. But yeah, they definitely could spread pretty quickly. I also wonder how hard it would be for Cheerios to maybe have, like, certain boxes go to different regions, and they'd have the right seeds in each box, mm-hmm. so that at least that way they would know that they're sending boxes to the right place where the plants would actually grow the right way.
Yeah. You'd have to have some knowledge about what needs to go where. Because for me, I'd just be like, great, plant the flowers, you know,
yeah.
not realizing, well, you shouldn't plant everything, you know.
It'd probably be really hard and expensive to pretty much sort it out like that.
Yeah. So good idea there by Cheerios, and maybe still effective, but you probably just have to kind of pay attention to exactly what you're planning. I've heard the same thing about palm trees, that they weren't native to, like, say, California and those areas, but they were brought there. I don't know. Again, I don't know if that's exactly true, but I've heard that.
Yeah, it would be interesting to find out where Micah heard it and get some more information about that. But yeah, apparently that's the case with a lot of things, where especially early in America, obviously we had the Spanish and the French here, and they would bring things over, and then even things from the Caribbean would come up here, and even if they weren't necessarily indigenous, they spread pretty quickly once they were here.
Yeah, even when you fly internationally, they're always concerned about, like, fruits and vegetables and food products. Like, what are you bringing into the country? And I'm sure there's different reasons for that. So that's always always interesting. This is another one sent in by a listener. This is kind of interesting story. It's from Fox News. Americans are camping in record numbers, but they still want Wi-Fi. Escape to the great outdoors, but I wanted to check my email, you know. I understand it. I would relate to that. They say since 2014, the percentage of campers who say that they take three or more camping trips a year has increased by more than 36%. So people are getting more active in camping, especially those who like doing it. In 2017, half of all campers surveyed said that they're planning to spend even more time camping this year. More than half of millennials surveyed, 51%, said that they plan to go camping more often in 2017. Millennials also mark the age range to most enjoy the activity in large groups, 10 or more travelers. So they like to travel in packs. And hopefully they're cordial campers. They don't want to run into a pack of rowdy campers.
No.
But they say neither millennials nor campers in general are completely cutting the cord. Of course, I guess they are because it's Wi-Fi, but never mind that. According to the study, 95% of people who go camping bring some sort of technology with them, while 37% of campers said that some sort of tech was actually required for their trip, which I could see. You know, if you're using a GPS to get somewhere, I guess if you went out far enough camping, you might run out of Wi-Fi or whatever connectivity you're using, your phone network. About half of the survey respondents indicated that at least free Wi-Fi was a big factor when deciding where to stay. And when it comes to sleeping, conventional tents were the most popular, according to the study, but the number of campers electing to use RVs or cabins is also increasing. So it's interesting. I've been camping a few times, always enjoyed it. It was pre-internet times, so that was never even a thought, but if we go on vacation, we typically don't go camping, I guess, but we always like to have Wi-Fi and all that, just so you can keep up with what's going on, I guess.
Yeah, it's hard for me to even really understand why you would go camping unless you could disconnect. That's really the main benefit for me, or at least from what I can think of. Obviously, maybe fishing and being out in the woods is nice too, but you know, if you're just watching as many videos as you did at home, it's kind of like you're defeating the purpose of going out there.
Yeah, you know, it is interesting. I've been thinking about this for myself, and it's kind of an interesting, maybe little test is, you know, when I feel like grabbing my phone and looking at it, I don't really have a reason to. It's just a kind of a crutch, I guess, or a habit. And I think, well, what if I didn't? I mean, what would I do? I don't know. I would think maybe, or
exactly.
And I was thinking about camping. You know, you're kind of sitting out there just enjoying nature, and hopefully, if you're with some people, having some good conversations. But there is almost like a little bit of a panic, I guess. Like, what am I going to do though?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're just going to talk to each other. And I don't think I'm heavily into my phone, but I certainly do use it. Some would be into it more, some less, and it is like I've even seen a story or a headline where they talked about how that was one of the biggest moments of panic for people when they couldn't find their phone.
Hmm.
I mean, it was up there with like really serious issues. We are so used to it that when it's not there, it almost feels like, what do we do now?
Right. Well, we're actually to the point where most people will actually laugh when they see someone trip and fall or something like that. But if that a phone actually crashes to the ground, that's the moment of panic for them. That's very, very serious. Never laugh at that, because obviously they want the phone. They don't care so much if their friend just broke their arm, as long as the fall was funny.
Right. Yeah, right. Well,
that's really what's happening now. I've seen a lot of videos where things like that actually happen.
That happens all the time. There was a story, I think it was off a Drudge Report. Some guys got into a fight in Las Vegas on the street. And I think the reason it got attention was because they were dressed up like, they were just dressed funny. But everyone, again, people filmed, but nobody called because the guy did need some help.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody did jump in and try to help, but nobody called 911, or at least the guy filming didn't. And people are like, you know, call 911 and I'm going to keep filming the video here. And so it's really this weird sort of situation where everybody's becoming a filmmaker,
right?
Like throughout the normal day, and that happens with auto accidents. It happens with all kinds of things where they're like, "Oh, this would be an interesting video," and they're disconnected from the reality of somebody needs my help here.
Mm-hmm.
Not that happens to everybody, obviously, but there are instances where you see that.
That really is a trend. That seems to happen a lot. And anytime you see that, you just wonder, why are there 20 people standing around filming or laughing about it, and yet if they drop their phone, they would freak out.
Yeah. It'd be somebody else filming the phone dropping.
Yeah.
It'd just be like this chain of filming these different things happening. Here's one. This is just kind of a lighter note, but I think it's kind of funny. Because I occasionally do watch Wheel of Fortune, not all the time, but occasionally I'll turn it on and try to solve the puzzles before the contestants do. Some days I'm really on. Other days I'm really, really off. But this happens occasionally where it's really obvious and the person makes a blunder. Wheel of Fortune contestant could have greatest miss in show's history, they say. Oh. A player identified as Kevin was one letter away from solving the puzzle, and it read, a streetcar named Desire. The only thing missing was the M in named.
Oh, no.
So all the letters that were up there spelled a streetcar, N-A, blank space, E-D, and then Desire. So he decided to spin the wheel again, and he landed on the $600 piece. So he had to pick a letter. He picked the letter K, thinking that the puzzle was a streetcar naked desire.
I couldn't actually think of another letter that could go there besides
right.
M, but I guess that makes sense too.
Yeah. Yeah. Even if you weren't familiar with the famous work there by American playwright Tennessee Williams, I don't know, you think that would just, you'd think named as opposed to naked, but I don't know. He was wrong, of course, and the crowd let out a collected gasp. The opponent to Kevin's left then correctly solved the puzzle, a streetcar named Desire.
No.
So the thing about prices, or Wheel of Fortune, sorry, is that even if, I think it's a combination. Like sometimes it's a matter of the spelling and the letters, but in other cases it's just a matter of once you see a few of them, you know what the phrase is. You know, and you think, oh, that's a famous phrase. And most everything up there is a famous phrase of some kind. So you, even if you just get a few of the letters, you're like, oh, I bet that's what it is. And you can kind of guess from there. And so, but this guy just never heard of that, apparently. So he thought it was a streetcar naked desire. You have to ask yourself when you're solving the puzzle, like, would this make sense? Like, is this something that they would put up there? And the poor guy, poor Kevin, he had to live with that, and will have to live with that for the rest of his days.
Yeah, he must have lost out on a lot of money, too, to be one letter away from solving the whole thing. And it's not just that he lost, but he directly gave it to his opponent, basically, yeah. By eliminating the only other letter, I'm pretty sure, that you could even put there. It's actually funny, because every time I've seen a big mistake where there was only one letter left, it always spells something like filthy. it's always something where, like, how did you even think of that when
yeah.
There's all these normal phrases that you could have chosen?
Yeah, right. And that's probably is even a little more embarrassing, not just that he didn't know it, but that he thought it might be the other one. That there's pressure going on those shows, because I think sometimes, you know, if there wasn't the pressure, people would easily know something, but they just kind of clamp up in the moment and do something that is silly. Or, you know, a lot of times they'll pick a letter that's already on the board like five times. And there's like five T's there, and they're like, T? And Pat Sajak always, nope. That one's already up there.
Does that actually cost them their turn when they?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
that's
your
terrible.
Turn on that one. So they've got to have some great laughs behind the scenes. Maybe someday Pat Sajak and Vanna White will write a little tell-all book. You know,
that would
behind
be amazing.
The scenes at Wheel of Fortune. So.
It's so easy to just sit back on the couch and laugh at those poor people who mess up, but there's millions of people watching. It probably most of us would choke.
Yeah, a lot of pressure. I've always wondered, too, if they ever have contestants that they just can't show the program. Like, they just get really mad or... Because you never see it, but that doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
Right. So they're all pre-recorded, aren't they?
Sure.
Yeah, so you would never know if there was a total botch.
Right. Or somebody just was upset and, you know, this wheel isn't fair, and you know, I'm always getting bankrupt. I think it'd be interesting if you could spin the wheel for your opponent. Because then it'd be more strategy, like you're trying to bankrupt them and
right.
trying to lose a turn, and a little more animosity between the contestants.
Oh, that would actually make some great TV. They might be due for some changes. They've been on TV for so long
yeah.
to attract new viewers. A lot of the time what you need is some good conflict.
This is kind of an interesting one. Some of the listeners might find this interesting. If you enjoy Guinness beer, and if you've been to Dublin, Ireland, they have that's where it originates. They say, love beer? You can spend the night at Dublin's Guinness storehouse with Airbnb. It's a contest. Airbnb, of course, that's for people, if you want to go somewhere and it's like staying in a hotel, except it's somebody's house or their apartment, they rent it out. Airbnb, it's kind of a popular thing for some people. So they're going to do this for one night at in Dublin. You can spend a night at the 258-year-old Dublin brewery itself. I have been to Dublin. I never got over there to see that. I wanted to see it. It's on the bucket list. The catch, they say, to prove you're worthy. Are you worthy of sleeping among Ireland's most precious taps? You'll have to first explain why you're the world's biggest Guinness fan. So there's a little contest going here for them. The one-night-only sleepover on April 24th is part of Airbnb's Night At series, a string of competitions that has gifted winners overnights at London's Abbey Road Studios, within the Paris catacombs, even in Hamlet's castle in Denmark, moat included. So all these really great places that you could never really stay at, they're setting it up so you can stay there for one night, which would be awesome.
Yeah, it would. And it's not just so much that you're sleeping there, but the fact that you're transported to that location. And pretty much it's a free vacation, at least for a day or so.
No one's going to sleep. If you're in Hamlet's castle, you're not going to be like, well, I'll probably turn in. You know what I mean? You're going to spend the whole night like running around.
I'd probably fall asleep at 7.
How did you enjoy it? You're like, it was pretty good.
I saw a couple things, but I was mostly asleep.
Yeah, I think you'd want to run around and make the most of it. But they say for this occasion, the famous gravity bar at the Guinness storehouse will be transformed into a fully equipped loft, complete with the perfect pint-shaped bed, a butler, presumably on hand to pour you actual pints, life-size Jenga, so you can have some fun playing that, a Guinness tasting bar, and panoramic views of Dublin to be admired through a handily provided telescope. So they're setting up, you know, lofts or places you can enjoy the night and sleep there and play these games, again, in places that aren't normally, you know, like we could set it up here at the KPCG.FM studios.
Set up a contest, see who wins.
Airbnb.
Biggest KPCG fan.
One night. We'd have to turn the mics off, of course. But this would be really pretty exciting for somebody, and I think that would be great, especially some of them, like Hamlet's Castle any of those places. Paris Catacombs, that one makes me a little – I don't know a lot about that one. That makes me a little nervous, but
– sounds scary.
What would be a good one? Lambeau Field for the Packer fans.
Get a free tour of the stadium.
Sleep out on the 50-yard line.
In the middle of frozen winter.
get the full experience. Yeah, I could see them doing this at all kinds of sports venues. Any place that's famous that people would want to get to and just spend them. That's a really neat promotion. That's a good idea.
Yeah, actually, a sports clubhouse would be pretty nice. A lot of luxurious things are in there usually if you're talking about the top level.
Mm-hmm. So there'd be some neat ones. And then, again, some historical ones too, like Hamlet's Castle in Denmark. I was trying to think of what another historical one would be. I guess it just depends on what people are interested in.
Maybe within one of the tombs of the Egyptian kings.
Oh, wow, yes. That's exactly what it would be. Inside the pyramid. Spend a night in the pyramid.
Ooh.
In the actual, they could set up the bed where it looks like it's a coffin.
Right.
Yeah, whatever they call those things.
I forget what it's called. Yeah.
I want to say sarcophagus. Is that right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
So you're like, you're not going to close this, right? That would be pretty fantastic, especially for the history buffs out there. I suppose in some cases you just wouldn't be allowed in some of those areas, but that'd be pretty great. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link, too, at thetrumpet.com. Kia David program's coming up today, as well as the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, also the Trumpet Hour program. Make sure you listen for those. The Kia David today is two segments, and they're both on He Was Right, talking about Herbert W. Armstrong and some of the prophecies he made. And there's a really great book that goes with that, He Was Right. You can find that at thetrumpet.com. It's a free, as is all the material there. Check it out. It's the new and revised trumpet.com as well. And make sure you listen for that program coming up here in a bit on KPCG. Grant, you've got an interesting write-up for us. This is from Breitbart. Cubans are still fleeing on the high seas months after Obama nicks his wet foot, dry foot. So this is an interesting situation. This was in the news a while ago when the former President Obama did get rid of this wet foot, dry foot policy. It's right in the middle of this push for open borders from a lot of people and wanting kind of immigration to just really be opened up. But then they stopped this wet foot, dry foot. Maybe you could explain just briefly what wet foot, dry foot is for the Cubans.
Right. Well, I believe this started back in 1966 during the height of the Cold War. So basically, Cuba was a puppet of the USSR, and they were right there on America's doorstep. So basically, to delegitimize the Cuban dictatorship, the communist dictatorship down there, the U.S. would say to any Cubans that if they reached land in America, if they escaped and reached land in America, that they could actually stay. However, if they got caught basically boating over, then they would get sent back. So that's what the policy was. I believe that was also renewed in 1995 by then President Bill Clinton, just restating that we are trying to delegitimize the Cuban regime. And that's really what it's all about.
Yeah, so the thing that I think was so interesting about it is, again, there's been such a push for, from some sectors anyway, for like open borders and so forth. And yet this is the opposite of that. And there hasn't been a lot of talk about it other than it coming back up in this Breitbart headline. I haven't heard anything about it since maybe the day it happened, mm-hmm. as far as it getting rid of that policy. It just seems like, well, but I thought it was open. I thought those people wanted open borders, you know, those that are really for it, and yet they don't seem to mind that the Cubans were not given that same right that they want others to have.
It's quite an extreme break from pretty much everything else that they believe regarding illegal immigrants from other places. Mr. Obama got rid of this on January 12th, and Mr. Trump took office on January 20th. So basically, as a parting shot, he told the Cuban people that he doesn't care much about them getting out of that country. And a lot of what he tried to do during his time in office was mend relations with Cuba, open up diplomatic ties, but also some different economic deals with the Cuban nation, as if that's somehow going to help the people, when really most people who have knowledge of the situation know that it's actually going to help the dictatorship.
Yeah. Really interesting. So the people that are left in the lurch here are the Cubans, and they're still risking it all to come to the U.S. And, you know, anybody that's seen some of that footage of those people on dinghies, if you want to call them that, or, I mean, I would be scared to death to get on one of those things, and I think most people would. But it just shows how bad whatever they're fleeing is. You know, I would never get on one of those unless I was being maybe chased by an army or something. Then I guess you would. But and it just highlights that they're coming, they're leaving a really bad situation, and in this case, it does feel like the U.S. should extend a little bit of help for them on some level. But we're not doing that anymore, and so you do feel for the people caught in the middle.
Right, and that's really a difficult part of this is when Mr. Obama got rid of this wet foot, dry foot policy, basically it means that the Coast Guard can catch you on the seas and send you back to Cuba, and even if you make it to shore, when in the past you would have been free to try to become an American citizen and you wouldn't get sent back, now even if you make it to shore and you're caught, you still will get sent back. So this has left a lot of Cubans in a panic. A lot of Cubans who have tried to come up through Central America to reach the U.S. are now stranded because those countries will no longer be helping to transport them up through Central America and into the country. And then, of course, those who are trying to go by boat the 100 miles or so to the tip of Florida, they know that it's going to be a lot more difficult to actually stay in America, even if they land. So far, since this has been in action for a little bit over 2 months, they've still apprehended 65 Cubans who have still thought it worth it to come over, even though they know that they'll get deported no matter what if they get caught.
Yeah, and I just haven't seen any big protests about that. I mean, there may have been some. I shouldn't say that. Within the communities, especially in Florida and those areas where the people have come from Cuba, they've been upset about it. But I just haven't heard it like get any traction in the media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I guess to be fair, I should say that even if they get detained, they kind of have a chance to protest being deported, but there's really not much of a chance at all of that being successful. Even if they're fleeing from poverty and a lack of opportunity basically imposed on them by a dictatorship, they can still get sent back. That's what's happening. And it seems like only the Cuban Americans feel passionately about it. And the only people on the left who this has reached are the ones who happen to also be Cuban. So this is maybe the one area where they break from Mr. Obama, is because they've actually had family and friends who have experienced this policy. And that seems to be what we're always saying. The people who experience these idealistic liberal policies are not usually too happy about it, because they have to suffer the consequences. That's what's happening here. And yet the Cubans are so desperate to get here that even if they're caught, they know they're getting deported. They know they're getting sent back. They start drinking gallon jugs of bleach.
Wow.
To try to kill themselves or extremely harm themselves so they don't have to go back and suffer under that regime.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That is just absolutely amazing, because there is, I don't know, I guess there's been sort of a picture painted of Cuba as if it's, you know, all joyous music and 1950s automobiles and things like that. Like it's a great situation, but when you see people willing to do that, like you mentioned, to not go back, what kind of a place, you know, what is going on there? The Trumpet Hour talked about that months back when Fidel Castro died. I think it was on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show too, about just some of the things that people have been subjected to under the Castro regime if they were thought to be an enemy of the state, which it doesn't take much to be an enemy of the state. You almost don't even want to mention it. But it's back on those programs if you want to go back and listen to that. That's what those people are facing back there in Cuba.
Yeah, it really is a horrible situation. And there has been a lot of speculation, even among the Cubans trying to flee, about why Mr. Obama would do this to them. And again, what is one of the biggest issues in the country right now? Whether or not there should be a wall on the U.S. southern border between the U.S. and Mexico, or whether there should be any type of security on that border. Why is it that with this one particular group of people that is actually being oppressed by a dangerous dictatorial regime, and that we should be trying to undermine because they are the communist enemy, why is it this one group of people that is being stopped from coming over?
Yeah, there's really good write-ups at thetrumpet.com about Cuba in general, and it is a serious issue because Cuba is it's like an aircraft carrier just sitting there right off our shore. And there's a really, really important write-up at thetrumpet.com. It's by Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury, The Deadly Dangerous U.S.-Cuba Deal. And that's from January 27th of 2015, back when that deal was made. It seems like a lot's happened since then, and it really has, but you don't want to lose sight of the importance of Cuba and what's going on there. And it is always interesting when you look at a lot of these different regions where it is a dictatorial regime. The concern about the people that live there is non-existent. North Korea, these other places, the governor, the people that are leading those nations, they do want power. They want to be powerful. They want wealth and influence, but they don't care about the people. And so, you know, I think if say the current administration came to, you know, the U.S. Populace in general and said, look, we think we really need to help out the Cuban people. Look what they're going through. Could we come to some sort of way to help them? As long as it was legal, you know, I think people would get behind that. There's sort of this idea like that part of America is just anti everybody else. And I don't think so. I think people are just against the illegal side of it. But when you see people suffering like this, if there's any way to help them, I think a lot of people would be on board with that.
Right. And the whole point about the wet foot, dry foot policy was that the Cubans who actually reached land were not considered illegals. And so people are fine with that. The thing is, when, you know, people are flooding across the southern border, they're not necessarily fleeing from a communist regime that will kill them. I mean, there is quite a big difference there, and if we can just have these things take place under the law, people would almost 100% support that, no problem. It's also important to think about what are these Cubans fleeing from. Clearly, communism is something that people will die to get away from, and yet we have people in this country, radical leftists, who are pushing for communism, pushing for their rights to be taken away, pushing for the government to have all-knowing control over the people. If they had experienced actual communism in action, they wouldn't feel that way.
Right. I think that desire to maybe have some of that, some of the ideology anyway from the communist side, is just from lack of understanding. That was talked about a while ago on the Trumpet Hour too. I think Abraham Blondeau, who's with us very often, was mentioning just some of the college students, and they thought it'd be fine to be under a dictatorial regime. And they it's just ignorance, because they don't really understand what they're saying, and because we're not under one. Mm-hmm. But again, if you ask people from Cuba, North Korea, some of those other places, tell us what your experiences are like, you know, we'd hear about it, and we don't even have to ask, because if people are willing to risk their lives to try to get away from it, and as you said, you know, even kill themselves to not go back, you know what kind of a situation they're coming from. That's pretty bad.
Right. And, you know, maybe if our college students are fine with being dirt poor, then they would be okay with that. But the thing is, it's not very hard to get on the bad side of a regime like that, where, you know, if you have a relative say something bad about the rulers, then you could be put in prison for it too. That's the case in North Korea, a communist, basically, shell or a puppet state that really is reclusive. They put people in labor camps if, you know, your fifth cousin removed says anything bad. That's just reality. It's like you can't avoid suffering over there.
Yeah, there's really good write-ups, historical ones, about Russia, other places where it didn't take much to have somebody show up at your door and say you're going to the gulag.
Even if you are just totally supportive of the regime.
And once you're accused or branded, there is no, you know, they're not going to, it's not like here in the U.S., they're not going to bring you in and say, all right, well, let's have a trial, and it's going to be very public, and everyone can put the evidence out there. You know, you're guilty because we said so. Mm. It's a really bad deal. So interesting right up there from Breitbart again about the Cubans, the situation that they're under and still trying to get to the U.S. even after the end of this wet foot, dry foot policy, because it was revoked. And there's a lot of good write-ups at thetrumpet.com. Another one is the disastrous Cuba deal 1 year on. That's an update to that article I mentioned before again. That's by Stephen Fleury, host of the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. And just a lot going on there in Cuba that's very important to look at. And you can find all that at thetrumpet.com. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Make sure you listen to the Key of David program, Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and Trumpet Hour coming up here today. For myself, Dwight Falk, and Grant Turgeon, have a great rest of your Wednesday, and we'll see you back here tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.